Joe Tunis. This is 95.2.
Now have a little listen to this. What images spring to mind? Well, 9 months ago, the Jane Austen Project Group, based here in Oxford, launched. And yes, I'm sure that you have wonderful images of Regency costume as you hear this too. To delve into all aspects of the life and times of novelist Jane Austen, who you might not know was the daughter of an Oxford Don and whose mother came from Henley. It's a project that's been headed up by my next guest, Frank Underwood, whose interest in Jane Austen really started in earnest 4 years ago, although there were elements in his life prior to this that he'll share with us, in which she played a very large part. Frank joins us this afternoon to talk a little bit about the project group and what it's going to mean as we head to a significant anniversary next year for devotees of Jane's work. Welcome to the studio. Thank you for joining me today. Now, I'm very interested in an element of the project's research, if you like, that is revealing to people like myself that maybe don't know her as well as we should, that she was a very talented and accomplished musician.
Yes. Oh, hello, everyone. I'm Frank Underwood. Yes, that's right. A lot of her music, I mean, it was well known that she played the piano and obviously accompanied country dances, but that was an accomplishment at the time that most young ladies did anyway. But recently, music has emerged in her own handwriting. This is all being kept at Chawton House in Hampshire. And more are coming up, books with editions over the years from her childhood through to the end of her life, and then Austen family music continuing from there. And we get a kind of weird mixture from basic arrangements of folk songs to the simple country dances that virtually a beginner could play, to very complex sonatas. But more importantly, songs too. She was a songwriter.
And was this before or alongside the writing path?
Sort of went with it. I mean, what happened was, we know that she was taught by a chap called Dr. Chard, who was organist at Winchester Cathedral. He wrote music. And a lot of the early stuff, you can see where somebody has marked her manuscript book, you know, telling Jane not to play that or whatever. And then come the songs. And you can see, even in her early teens, because she had a lot of what were called juvenilia books, one called The Beautiful Cassandra and Love and Friendship, which were very satirical. And there's one song in particular, which, oddly enough, this song has... I mean, I remember hearing this when I was very young, sung by Lonnie Donegan's Skiffle Group. And it's been recorded by people like Mickey and Griff, Dolly Parton and Johnny Cash, called The Irishman.
I mean, that's incredible. Just rewind that sentence again. A song written by Jane Austen has been performed by the likes of Dolly Parton and Johnny Cash.
Absolutely.
Tell us about it.
Well, this song, OK... date? Well, we don't know. Possibly 1796 to 98. It was never credited to her. It's generally thought to be a non or traditional. The tune certainly is an Irish traditional jig, but the lyrics, well, it puzzled people over the centuries, if you like. And then it was given out by a chap called William Shield, who wrote sort of ballad operas, including one of his operas. But again, there was no such thing as copyright in those days. And Jane, I mean, most women wouldn't have admitted to authorship. I mean, she didn't admit to the authorship of her books to begin with, and certainly not songwriting. But, you know, scholars and musicians have come saying, hold on a minute, this is very interesting. Look at the lyrics. Why Irishman? Why is... And the phrase, the chorus line is, no one can love like an Irishman. And she goes through all the nationalities, you know, lampooning them. And then there was a film a few years ago called Becoming Jane with Anne Hathaway. And the theme music was The Irishman, because she had a relationship, an affair, with a chap called Tom Lefroy when she lived in Steventon when she was in her late teens. And he was a bit of a wild chap. You know, he embodied the wild Irishman. Mm-hmm. Now, they split up. And that's another story. But, you know, it was at that point this song emerges. And I've seen, actually, a manuscript form in Chawton, the words, the music, and at the bottom, Miss Jane Austen.
Extraordinary.
And I think it said 1798, but it might have been 1797. Now, OK, that doesn't prove she actually wrote it. Nothing proves anything. But it, and the fact that it's also been used in the recent BBC film, Emma, you know, which was on TV, you've got somebody singing it in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, hold on. This has just got the wit and bite of a young, late teenage girl who's, you know, talks about, you know, the Irish and the nationality and relationships and so on.
And readers of her work will be so familiar with that style of hers.
It absolutely.
It must have been quite a revelation when suddenly the jigsaw pieces seems to all fall into place. Now, a lot of people will associate Jane Austen with Hampshire, obviously, but very strong Oxford connections.
Yeah, yeah. Well, OK, first of all, her family. Her mother came from Henley-on-Thames. Her father, who originally was from Kent, was a don at St John's College, the Reverend Austen. Both her brothers went to St John's, and Jane and her sister Cassandra, accompanied with a friend, actually came to school in Oxford. And that's an interesting whole thing that we're researching in the group. Where was this school? How long was she here? What did she do? Where did she visit? And so on and so forth. It was like a walking tour.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out, interestingly, I was at Brasenose College, and the woman that ran the school, rather ladies' establishment, I mean, it really wasn't a school, was known as Mrs. Corley, who was the widow of Ralph Corley, who was the principal of Brasenose. And so Elizabeth Boardman at Brasenose has done a lot of work, she's the archivist, uncovering the Corley history. And we know now that this place existed in High Street, sort of opposite Queen's, where the Angel pub used to be in.
So is Jane Austen's Oxford going to become something on the tourist map, do
Absolutely,
you think?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Be a really interesting element to bring to a city that's already absolutely bursting with incredible characters and creative minds that have lived here over the years.
Yeah.
I want to talk in a moment or two about, well, we've talked about her music, we've talked a little bit about her Oxford connection as well, but about how your life, actually, those two elements are mirrored slightly, because yours has been an extraordinary story of musicianship and academia as well. And I'd love to delve more into that and also talk more about, we mentioned 4 years ago when you really sort of took your interest in Jane Austen to a new level, but how she had been an influence in your household growing up as well prior to that. I'm Jo, and Frank Underwood is my guest this afternoon. We've been talking a little bit about the Jane Austen Project Group, which was founded 9 months ago, and in fact, it's been maybe sharing a side of Jane Austen's story, her own story, here in Oxford that you weren't aware of before. And we were talking, Frank, about the music, and in particular a piece called The Irishman, which was a very exciting discovery for fans of Jane Austen. Also, her involvement and her schooling at one point here in Oxford.
Yeah.
And rather similarly, your life has touched Oxford and music in similar veins. Your family have lived in the city and in Banbury as well as London. But I want to talk about the musical side of your life to start with, because I believe it was when you took off backpacking around Europe in the 60s that you discovered somebody known as Bob Dylan, and that kind of changed things for you.
Yeah, I mean, OK, just to say that I had, a kind of traditional classical music background. I learnt the piano. I was always interested in early music, harpsichord and the lute. You know, I was always unconventional. I didn't want, you know, the standards, but something a bit different. And folk music was always there. And I think that I was sort of, I thought pop music was banal and absolute rubbish. And then one day, I can't remember what it was and who introduced it to me. I think I first heard Joan Baez, and that voice stunned me. Here was a woman with the shrillness, the voice of an angel. And then, funnily enough, the next day, I remember this, it was 1963, I heard a voice that came out of hell. And this person was singing about war and masters of war and then blowing in the wind. And I thought, my God, you know, it was like, and this was who? And this was a guy who had actually been in Britain, and he lived in London, and been on a play on the BBC. Bob who? And this man was going to change the world. And I wanted to know about this. This is what I wanted to do. And I taught myself guitar. I actually had a few classical guitar lessons. and I wanted to play folk, but more blues as well, acoustic blues. So I lapped up all that was going on, and within a year or two, I was playing and performing. And so the classical music sort of went faded in the background a bit.
Because you'd actually been offered a scholarship, hadn't you, to Magdalen College?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I didn't take anything of that up. And I went back to university later. I went to London University and South Bank University in London, but I did sociology and history.
But the music still was a very strong part of
absolutely.
Your life.
I mean, I was gigging at that point and doing stuff and meeting old people who later on became very famous.
Yeah. Well, a certain Miss Annie Lennox amongst them. Yeah. How did that meeting arise?
I met Annie Lennox in Camden Lock Market. She had a stall selling various bric-a-brac things, and we kind of clicked.
She was at the Royal Academy?
The Royal Academy of Music. Yeah. In fact, she left virtually before her final exams. I don't know why, she just, you know, decided not to do them. But yeah, we kind of hit it off together, as it were. She joined my band and recorded some of my songs.
Fantastic. Now, you, as you said, you university in London, it was sociology that you were studying there. And in fact, the academic world and academia has been something that, along with your music, has continued along your path. Because 3 degrees you hold on music, I mean, it doesn't get much sort of more intrinsic there, does it?
Well, yeah, that's a weird thing. None of the degrees are in music. You know, sociology, English and history of art and social history. But, I don't know why I kept... I mean, it's accused of being a perpetual student, I suppose, to keep the band going. I had to sort of have... But, yeah, I mean, my interest then... I was always interested in things from the past, whether it was past music. And I suppose folk music. I mean, even Bob Dylan was singing songs from the past. You know, he probably might have even sung The Irishman, for all I know. I'm going to look through the archives and see if... I'm sure there's a connection somewhere.
So what was it that brought you back to Oxfordshire?
Marriage, basically. Yeah, I got married and had children.
Because you had grown up in part in Banbury.
And part in Oxford.
And part in Oxford. And bringing it back round to the Jane Austen theme as well, although this project has been something that you've really indulged in over recent time... There was always a Jane Austen presence.
Yeah, it was my dad, really. I mean, all my family, both my sisters, but my dad and mum. I mean, he was always quoting from Jane Austen because, I mean, I was really young. I didn't know what this was about. And there were some pretty, I have to say it, wooden TV adaptations of Pride and Prejudice and Emma. But, you know, we always watched them as a family. And he would come out. I always think he was Mr. Bennet. Mm-hmm. My mother was Mrs. Bennet. And she used to talk about her tremblings and flutterings and vexations. And he would say, you know, say, "Your nerves, madam, have been my constant companions for the last 20 years, etc." And I thought this was very witty stuff. You know, where's this come from? And my sister, P&P, we've got P&P and S&S. And it's like, you have to decode, it's Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility. And so I kind of was brought up to... And the era always had a resonance, the dress, the costumes. Mm. And every time I went into a period building that was Georgian or Regency or whatever, it always felt right. I don't know why. When I first went to the Royal Pavilion in Brighton, I thought, wow... You know, wouldn't I love to live here? You know, Prince Regent, he might have been a bit of a, you know, I'm not particularly a royalist by any means, but, you know, he would have been an interesting chap to get drunk with.
He would have been, I'd never thought of it that way, but a very interesting character there.
Very, very knowledgeable, very intelligent, artistic.
I want to come back now to the group and the project itself, because... As we sort of said, it is still in its infancy, really, in its form that it is at the moment. Where do you see it going in the future, and what in particular are you hoping to achieve with it?
Worldwide fame and recognition.
Fun.
No. We've got the three projects, I suppose, are the music, obviously, Jane's music, and the music of the period. Then the biggie is Jane in Oxford and the Oxford connections. Also, we've sort of now gone into costume, fashion, and dance, the dances of the time. So all these kind of issues around the Austen world, if you like.
Because next year is going to be the 200th anniversary of the publishing of S&S.
Yes, S&S. And also the 200th technical anniversary, if you can call it that, of the Regency. I mean, it was in February 1811 when Prinny was made regent. Mm-hmm. Although the style goes back to the 1790s. But yeah, so there's a lot of media. BBC have been in touch. There's stuff going on at the Royal Pavilion in Brighton that we're invited to. Stuff at Chawton, that's Jane Austen's house. All the people that have played in Sense and Sensibility. We've got Emma Thompson, Kate Winslet, all the other people in S&S are going to be there.
It's going to be something to see, won't it? You will be there. But I know a few years ago you were involved in a Guinness Book of Records attempt that revolved around Jane Austen. Is that
right? No, that was last year in Bath. But there's a Jane Austen Centre in Bath, and every year they have a Jane Austen Festival in September, which is brilliant. I mean, loads of people come from all over the world. And they had a Guinness Book of how many people could dress in Regency costume authentically and cram into the assembly rooms in Bath, which holds 1,000 people.
You were a part of that.
Yeah, oh yes.
Is that something you'd like to try and re-break the record of here in
Oxford?
No,
not really. Well, I mean, you know, I mean, the thing is, I didn't set out to costume up and become a reenactor. But once you start wearing, you start to look like Mr. Darcy. It's amazing the reaction you get from people.
I was going to say, and there are not going to be many women in this county that are going to argue with that look.
No. The women look at you. You're invisible before, you know. And I've known that performing. You suddenly become something. When you leave the stage, you're just Joe Ordinary. And the same applies. I walk around Bath, swanning around Bath with the hats and the cravats and the cane, you know, the breeches.
Garner plenty of attention.
And you're taller. You know, you have to walk right. And do you know the funniest thing? The girls, they curtsy to you and so you bow back. And you think, what are you doing? You know, and I've met ladies, girls in Bath and elsewhere that just say they love to wear the costume and they think this age needs something because everything's so violent and rude and uncouth and stuff like that.
A return to a far more pleasant
era. But it's a myth, really, because, you know, we do try and say to people, hold on, you know, it wasn't quite like that. It was a tough time. I mean, Dickens said it, the best of times, the worst of times. You know, and you could get hung for a sheep. You could be transported.
Yeah, well, the life and times, as we've said, are really the key of the project group that you're setting up here. What about people listening now who've suddenly fallen under the spell for the first time or hearing you talk and just saying, this is how I felt all along about the period? Are there ways that they can get in touch?
You can give me a ring.
Yeah.
My phone number is Oxford 01865 515295. You can look at our website, which is www.janeaustenproject.org, or you can look me up on Wikipedia. Can I just say now just a thank you to two people who have made this happen? One is Lizzie Horn, she's listening in, or from the University of Buckingham, and she has done a lot, more than a lot, to keep this thing going, and also to Nick Daisley, our webmaster, who set up the website. These people are invaluable, and they have my love and thanks.
And letting you go global as well.
Frank
Underwood, it's been a pleasure speaking to you today.
Thank you very much
for coming in. BBC Oxford, the afternoon show with myself, Jo, coming up for 2:45. And if you would like more detail on the website and on the Jane Austen Project Group, but you were unable to write down the website address then, just give us a call. We'll fill you in with the details.